I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. And I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. And today, members, we have the Commissioner of Revenue with us. And we're going to go through the governor's tax proposal. It seems like that was 100 years ago to the House because the House has enacted so much of the governor's tax proposal. Or we've not enacted it, but we've passed it to our friends in the Senate. So I think a lot of members, you know most of what the governor proposed because we've already passed it. But we do want to, you know, touch on that just briefly and get to the pieces that have not been sent to the Senate yet. And so with that, I'm going to just ask the commissioner to join us and talk to us about what he wants to do. And I know he's needed with the governor at a certain time and has to leave, but we would like to start anyhow. And so I'm going to go ahead and move before the committee House File 3122 for possible inclusion, what's left of it, in the next omnibus tax bill. Welcome, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the Tax Committee. It's always good to be here. And I bring warm greetings from the governor, who is getting up and around more and more as we speak. So I just wanted to convey his deep sense of gratitude on behalf of the governor for your quick action on House File 1777, and in particular, Madam Chair, I want to congratulate you on such great leadership to get that heard, to get it passed, and now awaiting approval with the other body. So, but thank you all very much, because I know you worked hard. You heard a lot of testimony, and there are a lot of competing bills, and we really do appreciate that. And part of that, though, frankly, Madam Chair, is something else I wanted to comment, is your continuing support of federal tax conformity, the need to do that in terms of simplicity for our tax filers, but also for tax relief. It's a great way to provide that, and you are undoubtedly one of the legislature's champions in that area, and thank you for that, for your leadership.
Thank you for your kind words.
On also on behalf of the governor, I'd like to mention that I wanted to express his appreciation for your work on the unsessioned bill as well. One of the things that we put together with the Department of Revenue was to try to articulate and find those outdated sections that are in the code that we need to eliminate. And working with Chair Lincheski and with your staff, we were able to come up with some additional suggestions from the House research staff. And we think the unsessioned bill has gotten even better with your input. We really appreciate that as well. And I should just take a moment. I know you're really good about doing this, Madam Chair, and that is thanking the people who work behind the scenes, the House research staff, the Department of Revenue staff that are here. These folks, day in, day out, do all the hard work, and it's really without them we wouldn't be able to process this stuff the way we do. And I just want to give you my thanks for the House research staff and for the Department of Revenue people here today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can I just, I've just been told we have an amendment, and honestly, I don't know if it's coming from you or from technical fines within the staff, maybe. Do you have an amendment? Okay, we do. So, members, we're going to move, which we always do, the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape folks would like it. Do we know if it's in our packets? It is. Okay. So, Representative Benson, would you move the A14? Is that what it was?
Madam Chair, I would. A14-0879.
Okay. Is that right? Yes. Okay, great. So that's before the committee. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted to get the bill in the order that you would like it. So, great. Thank you. Sorry, we just wanted to get that processed.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate moving those things along. The, we all recall that in November we had a forecast that projected a surplus. And Governor Dayton at that time said that, and I quote, "There will be another budget forecast in just 3 months, which will update today's projections, and I will await that forecast before I submit my proposed budget revisions to the legislature. If that forecast holds, however, I expect to propose the elimination of all three B2B taxes and provide middle-class tax relief." Well, after the February forecast, where we have a $1.2 billion surplus, that's what the governor did. His budget proposal is a balanced approach where $616 million of the $1.2 billion is allocated to tax relief, $455 million for the budget reserve, and $162 million for essential expenditures. The budget, the tax, $616 million tax package is divided up into $301 million in middle-class tax cuts, $232 million in reducing business taxes, the B2B taxes, $43 million in estate and gift tax relief, $25 million in expanding the sales tax exemption for local governments, and $15 million in the angel investment credit. As Chair Lincheski mentioned, we have many similarities between the governor's bill and House file 1777. You've heard a lot of testimony. I'm not going to spend the time other than just to reiterate where we are similar. And I think the key is for the governor, by trying to match the state income taxes with the federal taxes, we can take advantage of those benefits, provide middle-class tax cuts, such as the marriage penalty relief, the working family credit. But I think a large component of what the House did in House File 1777 and what the governor did is retroactive relief to tax year 2013. There's some slight differences, but in the governor's bill, there's about $57 million in immediate tax relief for taxpayers filing right now. The similarities, obviously, the governor's bill and both House File 1777 eliminate the marriage penalty going forward by increasing the standard deduction. It's a permanent change going forward. By increasing the working family credit, both the governor and House File 1777 provide a larger benefit for many families and extend the benefit to 13,000 more families throughout Minnesota. The one major difference between the governor's bill and House File 1777 is the child care credit. The governor redesigned and expanded the child care credit he's expanded it so that it would cover 170,000 families with qualifying child care expenses. This would eliminate the phase out now that starts at $25,000 and the income cap of $39,000. The average credit increase for the governor's proposal would be $430 per family and would cost about $73 million per year. As we know, the child care is a major expense now for families. And in fact, in Minnesota, it's one of the third highest states with child care expenses. We estimate that about 15.5% of median income is for child care expenses. We believe that this proposal makes child care more affordable and also more realistic for those stay-at-home parents who need to and want to go to work. The current version of the child care family credit, the child care credit, is helpful for many families, but we believe with the redesign of the child care credit, it goes further and to more families. Just give you a quick example. Right now, a family that earns $40,000 a year with two children and at least $6,000 in qualifying expenses, they do not receive any Minnesota child care credit now. Under the governor's proposal, that family would receive $1,320 in tax credit per year. So this is, as I mentioned, one of the major differences between the governor's bill and House File 1777. The governor's bill and House File 1777 also help home foreclosures by expanding the federal credit to those folks who have lost their homes through foreclosure or at a loss. As you know, the Congress expanded that to the federal code last year, and the House File 1777 and the governor's bill both provide relief for those families in need. The other area that the governor and House File 177 are similar are in the student loan interest deduction and tuition deduction. This bill and House File 1777 help both current students and former students. It helps with students who have debt, repaying that debt by providing an interest deduction, and it helps current students with tuition deductions already. Obviously, it's going to help make education more affordable and provide that upward mobility that we'd like to see for our families. The final two I want to mention, that where we do match, and that's how the governor's bill and House File 1777, both include the Employer Adoption Assistance Program, which is critical for those families that are adopting children, and it expands the credit from $5,000 to $10,000. It obviously helps those families in need at the time that they're adopting. And finally, the governor's bill and House File 1777 help thousands of small businesses by making their taxes lower and simpler. Under this proposal in House File 1777, these businesses will not have to keep two sets of records going forward. One of the things that happened when Congress approved these changes in 2013 is that if we don't retroactively make these changes, there'll be a permanent set of differences between the state taxes and federal taxes. And so this package of extenders is only about $8 million a year, but it really makes a difference for small businesses. So I'd like to thank the House for taking such quick action on the House File 1777. We only have the only other two differences. We did not, the governor did expand the income levels for itemized deductions, and he did expand the income levels for personal exemptions, somewhere else where we differ. I just wanted to take 1 minute to clarify something that I think that obviously you folks understood and have passed and put the bill in play for the governor to sign, and that was the need to do this right now. You know, you've heard us talk about March 19th. As many of you know, for these changes to be implemented, we need to redesign, change forms, revise our computer code, but we also have to test it. And then we have to go to software vendors. They have to do the same thing. They have to revise their codes. They have to test it. Then we have to make sure they work together. And most software providers simply stop making these changes around April 1st. Obviously, the last 2 weeks, April 1st, April 15th, is a real important time for the tax filing season. We estimate that about 41% of all taxpayers file in that two-week period, or about 1.1 million taxpayers. So our goal in getting the bill passed and signed by March 19th was to enable us to do our work at the Department of Revenue, turn around and do our work with the software providers, and make sure that those folks who begin filing on April 1 have the correct law and can get their tax savings immediately. Now, if it doesn't happen, then obviously it's going to be a problem, because then those folks who aren't able to file with the new changes will have to file amended returns in some cases. One of the things that we will do, even with making these changes immediately, is we do have the ability in some cases to go back for taxpayers who have already filed, and we can make some of these changes for them. We will have enough information. Some taxpayers will require more information and we'll contact them, and some taxpayers will have to file amended returns. So I just want to say how much the governor appreciates your fast action, because your action put an opportunity for us to get this done in time to make these changes, so that the last 2 weeks of the filing season, we do have the new law in effect and people are getting their immediate tax savings. The other area I want to mention, just a little bit of difference on the business-to-business sales. Similar to the House, the governor repeals the three business-to-business sales taxes that were enacted in 2013. We have a little bit of difference in the effective dates. The governor repeals the electronic and commercial equipment repair and maintenance effective April 1. He repeals the telecommunications equipment effective April 1, and the warehousing and storage services tax effective April 1 as well. I think you had some retroactive changes for the repair services and also a different date for the telecommunications. Well, obviously, we would like to get this done again before April 1st, because if we don't get this enacted before April 1st, starting as early as next week, we're going to have to, as a department, start issuing some guidance for warehousing folks to start collecting the tax on April 1. The new items that have not passed out of House File 1777 included the estate and the gift tax changes. The governor proposals retroactively eliminating the gift tax, making Minnesota more in line with other states. As we know, only one other state has a gift tax, Connecticut. The governor's proposal does retain the three-year look-back rule. You probably all recall that last year that was enacted as part of the estate tax to make sure that those deathbed gifts, as we call them, they don't occur, and it doesn't provide a mechanism to escape the estate taxes. So we would retain the three-year look-back rule in the estate tax, but repeal the gift tax retroactively. This would cost about $17.7 million for this biennium. The governor also proposes raising the estate exemption amount from $1 million to $2 million over a five-year period. And also, one of the important reforms is eliminating the complicated estate tax bubble, as we call it. Jenny Starr, in charge of our tax policy in the department, as you know, has testified about that very eloquently, and there's a report out about the estate tax that explains how this complicated estate tax bubble came to be, but it certainly is one that I think we'd all like to see eliminated, but it takes some money. The overall cost of eliminating the estate tax bubble, raising the estate tax, starting to raise the estate tax exemption this year is $25 million for this biennium. Again, this reform for the estate tax would make Minnesota more consistent with other states who are also, in general, raising the exemption level up from 1 million to 2 to 3 to 4 million throughout the United States. One other area that the governor has proposed is the angel investment tax credit. He's proposed increasing the appropriation this year for the remainder of this biennium to $15 million. The governor believes that we can help businesses grow by encouraging equity investments in startup and emerging companies. Obviously, a lot of these investments have focused in high tech or new technology. We would extend the angel investment credit to 2017 under this proposal. We now know that over 20 states offer a similar angel investment tax credit to spur investment, and the recent study that you all have heard did promote the number of certified businesses that have been awarded angel tax credits, about 767 businesses. Over 2,100 investors have qualified. Over 80 different funds have participated in the angel investment credit, and we've generated some $208 million of investment in certified businesses. Another area the governor has proposed is expanding the sales tax exemption for local governments. The current exemption applies to cities, counties, and townships, and this new exemption would include all political subdivisions, instrumentalities, special districts, special taxing districts, and joint powers. This expansion of the exemption would cost about $25 million this biennium. Right now, we estimate there are about 500 to 600 different joint powers agreements, joint power entities, and special districts. Just a few remaining items that I want to mention that we've talked about and you've heard testimony about, and that is one about the so-called bins and tanks. One of the things that we underwent a study this last year under the help of Chair Davney and the Property Tax Division, and that was to study the taxation of equipment used in the biofuels, the wine, beer, distilled beverages, and dairy processing facilities. And we found that a better alignment of the tax code would be to treat these items as not taxable as equipment and therefore not real estate and taxable. These production-based industries would see some tax relief based on this new classification or this re-clarification of the law. The Department of Revenue's recommendation would reduce the values for some of these biofuels, alcoholic beverage, and dairy industries by about $30 million, which would translate into about a $780,000 reduction in state taxes statewide. And that is why we recommend a transition aid for those jurisdictions that might experience some loss in tax revenues to make that less of a problem and phase that out over 5 years. The governor's tax bill provides relief for nonprofits. This proposal increases the sales tax exemption threshold for nonprofits to $20,000. This has not been changed in over 20 years and would help eliminate some of the filing requirements for some of our smaller charities that work in our local communities. And finally, the governor's tax bill clarifies the taxability of webinars. This proposal excludes online training webinars from sales tax on digital audiovisual and digital audio works and would make the tax code, we think, more fair and would reduce confusion regarding when training is subject to taxation and when it's not. The cost to the state would be negligible. As you know, the webinars include such things as continuing professional and technical education, where credits are given for licensure requirements. When the digital products item was included in 2013, it was not the intent of the legislation to include these activities as taxable digital products. In conclusion, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for all the cooperative work that we've been able to engage in this so far in this quick and short session. I once again want to appreciate your support and strength on tax policy and your advocacy on behalf of the House position. I appreciate your continued partnership as we work forward to provide middle class tax relief to Minnesotans and tax relief to Minnesota businesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I know Ms. Starr is here for questions, and I want to alert the committee that there's a lot of people from the Department of Revenue in the room, and we will go to questions, but I do want to just briefly say I want to read into the record that Mr. Nelson is here from Deed and Mr. McKinnon from Dean, and we understand they're available for questions on the Angel Credit. But we aren't taking testimony on that. Is that right, Mr. Nelson? I'm looking on you, at you, because we've done that in this committee already. And I just want to point out to members that we have 12 people on the list, and I know I don't normally keep a list, but I know that 12 people are on a list who'd like to testify on this bill, and there's probably more. So I'm just walking through a few things here. So we're done at 2. The commissioner has to leave soon to be with the governor, so we want to have questions of you first, Commissioner. What I would suggest is, we'll get to that next, but we cannot get a room until 8 o'clock, members. So just keep that in mind, because if the public can't testify, we're coming back at 8. Ms. Locke has been working on it the whole time here, trying to find a room. We could go over to the Capitol, but geez, in the House, we just don't like to do that. So so we're looking at an 8 o'clock come back, because the Property Tax Committee is marking up their division report until then. So we do want to go to the public, but first, before the commissioner leaves, we'd like to take some questions. So I have Representative Davids and then Draskowski. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to the committee. And as with Ms. Starr there, now she's the Senior Manager for Tax Policy, I believe. She could probably be a good Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, Commissioner.
Madam Chair. Representative, now you should all know that it was about a year or so ago that Chair Davids, a couple years ago, was talking about Assistant Commissioner Mossman as Deputy Commissioner, much before I had made that decision, actually. And he since became Deputy Commissioner and now has moved up to be Deputy Chief of Staff. So thank you for that suggestion.
So, Ms. Starr, you have a bright future, I'm sure. And Commissioner, I thank you for your urgency on getting things done here. And they're just logistically, I agree with you 100% that we need to get things done, but you're kind of preaching to the choir. We did 126-2 vote under the leadership of Chair Lincheski and moved that bill over to the Senate, so I hope you'll take the same message over there, and I hope they're receptive over there. A couple things that I want to caution us for. We're all excited about the unsession. What could possibly be better than repealing old laws? Well, it's fine until there's some old laws that tremendously benefit your legislative district. For example, I'll give you a couple. There's three of them that were brought up. One is the 4C legislation. As I was driving to my endorsing convention on Saturday, I usually don't go to those, but I got a better chance of getting endorsed that way. But I'm going over to Rushford, and because of what we did, and the governor signed into law the 4C legislation, we have a brand new inn going up in Rushford, Minnesota. I don't want to be the one to break the news to him that what's in Chair Davney's bill right now would remove the 4C language. So I hope we'll watch out for that, because that is an effective piece of legislation that's actually working. So I don't want to count that in as anything to do with the unsession. And then also the seasonal restaurant on the lake legislation that has kept a business open, I believe, in Majority Leader Bach's district. Representative Davney is proposing to remove that, which I think would be extremely short-sighted and problematic, as you can imagine. And the other issue was the Minneapolis Club gets special consideration. And what my question is will be for Chair Davney, and I'll take the discussion to him later, is that I question why the 4C in his bill is gone, the seasonal restaurant on a lake is gone, but the Minneapolis is eliminated in the bill, but the Minneapolis Club worked its way back in to keep their provisions. That, I think, is extremely problematic when we have the Minneapolis Club being able to keep their special gift, their special tax provisions, and the 4C and the seasonal restaurant on the lake issues being repealed. So let's not go so quick on the unsession issues if they're included, because I don't know how to go tell the inn owner in that it's the same one that owns the one in Houston that is currently building the new inn in Rushford that now his property taxes are going to double or triple or whatever the number is. I think it puts him out of business. I haven't talked to him, so I can't say that with any authority, but I can kind of figure this stuff out. I was born on a day, but it wasn't yesterday, and I know what impact that has affecting those people affected by the 4C, and we fought very hard for that, and the governor signed in a law, and we have to be very careful on that. I think we need to move forward cautiously and not undo things that actually hurt our constituents, which SAD did. Maybe I should get the Minneapolis Club lobbying on behalf of 4C and the seasonal restaurant on the lake. I'm not sure, but I may go over and talk to them. So let's watch that closely. I think it'd be very short-sighted to remove Majority Leader Bok's provisions and the 4C provisions that are in there. And I understand how the place works, and I can kind of see where this is going, but for something that's not going to happen, I don't think we need the consternation of our constituents. When they see this going on, they'll be very perplexed as to what they might do. So I'm hoping, and I'll talk to Chair Dabney, that he can remove those two provisions very quickly. And if you could give the governor my best, I'd appreciate it. I hope he's feeling better every day.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. And I should say, Commissioner, so that was a very nice job of lobbying the commissioner to kill Representative Dabney's changes in his tax bill. That was interesting.
Bring out the artillery, the cavalry, and
I saw that. Commissioner, also you should know that in Representative Dabney's division report, which will be coming to this committee in a couple days here or a day or whatever, there are 6 classifications that are being eliminated of the 55, and the local property tax work group or whatever they were called had a recommendation to get those 55 classifications down to something, and Representative Dabney found 6. He would like to take a look at it, but I think those messages are being delivered right now as Representative Davids was speaking. I'm sure Representative Dabney will be talking to Representative Davids as well, and Commissioner, I'm sure it will be ongoing discussion. So thanks, Representative Davids. Appreciate it. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Franz. Curious, one thing you do differently that kind of piqued my interest than what we did here is that we did the repair tax retroactively, and I'm wondering if you had considered the implications of that. There's certainly a large number of businesses that this impacts that, at least that I'm aware of, that have not either may not still be collecting the tax or certainly did not collect it beginning July 1st. And there were numerous months where multiple businesses I know of were not collecting this tax because they're trying to figure out, first of all, what the Democrats in St. Paul did to them, and then secondly, how it was going to be implemented, and get their system in place, et cetera, communication with their vendors, that type of thing. So you've kind of got two groups of people. You got a portion, it might be half, it might be 40% or 60%, that paid the tax over time, and then a portion of people who did not pay the tax. So there's kind of a conundrum of how we deal with that. The House, Representative Lencheski's bill, does reimburse those retroactively. Your proposal does not, so I wonder, are we going to send the auditors out to chase down these people to collect this money? And if not, then you've, of course, got the situation of fairness where one group of people will have paid the tax and the other group of people will have gotten by without paying it. So I'm interested maybe in your comments or maybe just asking if you had considered those implications.
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, thank you for your concern and your comments. I think one of the things that concerned us about any retroactive the repeal and then the refunding of the prior taxes that were already collected was trying to put in place a new mechanism, if you will, to set up the refund mechanism, to provide the process where people who had paid the tax would seek a refund and how we would verify that and in the department and review those claims and get them back out. So one of our initial concerns was simply about the administrative difficulties in returning the money that was, in fact, paid in. Obviously, we would require people to have receipts and establish that they were the taxpayer, they had paid the tax. But I think overall, in looking at that process, we became concerned that it was expensive and it would take time. And we felt that the most efficient way would be just to turn off the tax or repeal the tax effective April 1 going forward. Certainly that is always a situation that you mentioned that some folks don't always get the message or make the correct payments. We always have that issue, and it's an ongoing issue. We try to be judicious in reviewing those taxpayers and those cases that we need to that haven't paid. But, one of the things that we would be careful about in this situation is making sure that people had the information to implement the tax and it was, in fact, implemented in a way that made sense. So our overall analysis was coming down on the side that administratively it was just an inefficient way to collect the money, then figure out a way to give it back, and it would take a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Commissioner, are you going to go back and have your auditors chase down those that did not pay it under your proposal, or just kind of whatever happened, happened, and we're good from April 1st forward?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, well, I think, you know, Representative, I think the key for us is always to maintain fairness. And I think the key, if people, the people who did pay in and deserve to be supported by everyone, not just the not just a few. So I think we'd want to be careful how we were to go back and examine some of those payments, but you know, nonetheless, the law was in effect and we would expect to enforce it, but we would want to do it in a way that makes sense given any uncertainties or any ambiguities that may have existed.
Thank you.
Lastly, quickly, Commissioner, so when you looked at the expense of reimbursing people retroactively, did you also consider the expense to the department to do the audits or not?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, sure, that was one of the way we tried to balance out the expenditure of resources, time, and energy. So that was the entire equation that we looked at.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Earhart, Schoen, Simonson, Zellers, and then we're going to go to public testimony, and we can come back to more committee questions. So that's, we'll have had six people. Can you stay a few more minutes, Commissioner? Okay, Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if the discharge of indebtedness from refinance or short sale is in your bill.
Representative Earhart, the bill we all voted out bipartisanly, House File 1777, and I should say for the record, that was very gracious of Representative Davids. You know this, Commissioner, but it's been very bipartisan in this committee to get that tax relief here, so it really has been kind of everybody. I will ask Mr. Michael to confirm it's in there so that everybody knows it's really in there. Mr. Michael, did you catch that? No, okay. Ms. Smith, is the principal indebtedness in House File 1777?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, it is.
And one other, did your bill repeal the gift tax?
No. Mr. Michael, we'll get the nonpartisan people, folks, people here to talk. There's a difference here now.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, House File 1777 does not include any changes in the in-state or gift tax other than to update to the Internal Revenue Code changes.
Thank you. I do intend to address the gift and estate in the next tax bill that we're taking up on Thursday. We're releasing to the public. So, was that it, Representative Earhart? Then we have Schoen, Simonson, Zellers. Representative Schoen.
I'll defer it to last because we're trying to answer my question.
Okay, Representative Simonson. Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question will be brief, but it's about the angel credit. And we just had, I think it was last week, we heard the report about, you know, the performance of the credit over the last number of years. And one of the things that was very glaring to me was the distribution of the credits on a geographical scale. And I'm just curious, I see that in your bill that we have $15 million that we're adding in 2015, and then another 30 into the out biennium. And I'm just curious your perspective on the geographical balance of the future of the past performance of this credit.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think actually that is better addressed by our comrades from D, but I think one of the things that they've been talking with other folks about the distribution of this credit, and I think it's something that everyone wants to make sure we get it right. So I'll have to defer to them in terms of working on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and Commissioner Ms. Starr, does the governor's proposal include a carve-off for Greater Minnesota?
No. No, Madam Chair, it does not.
Okay. So I think Representative Simonson, you're interested in some of that, and we have a lot of members bipartisanly who are looking at that, and I know you're aware the Senate is as well. So duly noted, Representative Simonson. Thank you, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, welcome back to the Tax Committee. So the one question I have, and Representative Drazkowski started down the road, the unwillingness to refund the taxes paid, and I want to be clear on this, that it's, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. It sounded like it was just going to be too tough, is the kind of the shorthand of it. And yet I've talked with business owner after business owner after business owner has had to have one of the audits done by the Department of Revenue. They don't get consideration. In fact, in a lot of cases, they don't even get common decency when it comes to what they're demanded from a revenue audit. Explain to me, and especially to those business owners, in a little more detail, why you can't do that.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner, please.
Representative, I think the overall concern was one of efficiencies and allocation of resources. One of the things that we wanted to analyze in the Department of Revenue was how best to set up a refund mechanism for this particular tax. How would we go about accepting the claims? How would we go about verifying the claims? And then how would we go about making sure that the money, because remember, the money has to get back to the purchaser, the person who actually paid for the service and paid the tax, not the retailer. So that makes this a little bit more complicated. So in our analysis, it was a matter of that it would be costly, and it would take time, and we felt that overall the most effective way going forward in terms of spending taxpayer dollars was to repeal it going forward, and to make sure that was a clear delineation and to relieve the burden of collecting it going forward.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to be clear to the second part of Representative Drazkowski's question, should you choose not to pay these taxes, would the Department of Revenue take a it's just too tough attitude in collecting them, or would they go after those business owners, probably fine them if they did not collect those taxes?
So, Commissioner, and I, Representative Zellers, you should know, has been a champion of repealing these taxes and carried a bill on that, and we've heard that bill. And the warehouse, of course, is not implemented. We're hoping to move the Senate before that, so then we wouldn't have to worry about refunds there. But, Commissioner, to Representative Zellers' question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think one of the concerns in looking back, if you will, over the last, since July 1, is how would you go about doing that? And I think the important aspect from the Revenue Department perspective would be making sure that any examination of that time period and the collection of those taxes would be done in the context of the speed with which it was adopted, any uncertainties that existed at the time, and the difficulties in implementing that tax. So we would, of course, look at the context of how the tax was implemented, but we would try to make sure that we enforce the law evenly and fairly to all taxpayers. That's our charge, and we would try to do it in this context as well. There just happens to be a few more factors to consider here than maybe in some other case.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, no offense, Commissioner, but that's BS. You're going to go after people, find them, take them to court in some cases for not paying taxes, yet it's just too hard to figure out how to get back. I think on behalf of a lot of business owners that have complained to me about this, that does not fly. It is absolutely incumbent upon you. If you overcollected, you had a bad idea, you're now admitting it, which I will congratulate you on, you're now going to give the money back. We believe you should give the money back. You say you can't because it's just too hard, or just too hard to figure out how to do it, yet it's absolutely we're going to enforce the law if they don't pay those taxes. I think this is one of the things, Commissioner, with all due respect, that makes us uncompetitive. What's good for the government is good for us. We will do whatever we have to the all ends. But if we have a bad idea, we're going to repeal it. We're not going to get back the money we collected. This is what drives business owners, hardworking women and men in our state, crazy about our business climate. I think it's unconscionable. If you say you're going to repeal these taxes, then you should give them money. If it was a bad idea now, then it was a bad idea when you started it last year. Last question, Madam Chair. Mr. Commissioner, you stated, I believe in this committee and in public before, that you believe there is absolutely no evidence higher taxes make people leave the state of Minnesota. Do you stand by that statement, Commissioner?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, in all these studies that we've reviewed, we have not been able to detect there's a measurable difference or flight, if you will, based on taxes from one state to another state.
So, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, absolutely. So that, I'll just take that as a short answer, yes, Commissioner, but you will stand by that statement that there is no evidence.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, in reviewing the studies, and looking at the studies that have been done have shown no recognizable trend based upon flight from one state to another. That's what we rely on.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, members, somebody's cell phone is by the microphones, or you have not powered it off, because we're now picking that up. So if you could do that. And, you know, I guess before we go to Representative Schoen, and then we're going to go to public testimony, and I know you have to go. But I would just say, Commissioner, I hope you will hear this group together wanted the refunds, and they're in the House File 1777. And it seems to me that the governor's been very supportive of House File 1777. And so my hope is if the Senate doesn't strip them out, I won't put words in your mouth or the governor's, but my guess is he would sign those refunds anyhow if that bill were to be on his desk with a refunding mechanism. So I'm hopeful for that. I guess I hope that this committee can contact our senators, both sides of the aisle, to really convince the Senate as they deliberate this week on this legislation that they do keep the refunds in. And I think we all kind of feel strongly about it around here. So we do know the Senate's kind of driving that ship right now, and they may take them out, and then we will all be faced with that in the House when it comes back. But if you could let the governor know that the House, at least in a bipartisan way, feels strongly that we like the refunding mechanisms that are in the B2B repeals. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Schoen, last question before public testimony, then we'll come back to public testimony. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I'm on page 39. I'm going to ask you about the 39.27 to 39.28. I'm wondering if your intention there related to the unless the structure is primarily used in the production of biofuels, wine, beer, distilled beverages, and dairy products. And I know that sounds like that's going to come out in the division report about mirrored language. Is it the intent to look at that as ag outputs in general, or is it just those specific ones? And I'll raise the concern of sugar production. In sugar production, it goes from the beet to a liquid, and then that could be that's taxed in the liquid form in the holding tank in the building, but then it wouldn't be when it goes into the bin when it's in dry form. So is it the intent for egg production, or just these, or egg outputs, or just these in particular? And that may need to be something that you discuss if it's not.
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to let Ms. Starr help on this one.
Ms. Starr is giving you the look like, somebody behind me probably wants to answer so. Representative Schoen's question. Is that the case, Ms. Starr?
Assistant Commissioner.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the language comes directly from the recommendations made in the study, and that the study was specific to the industries or the types of bins listed on the lines you discussed. Yes. I can look into the sugar production and beets question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's a fair way to handle it. Well, all I would point out is that if it's about storing grapes and then making them into a liquid form before it goes into wine, it's kind of in the same theory as sugar production too. Then it's something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schoen, and I know Representative Dabney is not here at the moment, but he worked on that report with his division, so we'll be talking about that more on Thursday. Okay, so. Thank you so much, Representative Schoen. With that, thank you, Commissioner. And Ms. Starr and all your staff is still here for more questions after we get through public testimony, but we're going to go to the public testimony next. And I would first call up, in fact, this person might be able to answer Representative Schoen's question. Representative Schoen, it's Tim Rudnicki from the Minnesota Biofuels Association. And I don't know, you're not here to answer Representative Schoen's question. You're here to testify in the bill. I understand that. But if you can work in the answer, too, if you know it, we'd be interested to hear it. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Yes, my name is Timothy Rudnicki. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association, and we're the trade association for biofuel producers in the state of Minnesota. To make a long story short, to the commissioner's point, a rather extensive study was conducted, and we want to extend our sincere appreciation to the Department of Revenue and recognize that a lot of thought and field research had gone into a very extensive report that clarified problems that have existed with the classification of various process components versus storage components. And to the representative's question, the study...
And he is listening, by the way. He's right there listening to you.
The study actually examines specific industries, in particular biofuels, beer, wine, distilled beverages, and dairy products. And there were a lot of complexities, but the simple, short solution is embodied in the governor's bill. And to put it In simple terms, if a process component is removed from this mechanism used to make biofuels, we know that is a personal property item. If the component, let's say it's a storage component which has raw ingredients or finished products, they're clearly defined as being at the beginning of the process or the end of the process. So the recommendation, and again the governor's bill, clearly provides a test that can be used to properly classify these components. And I think what's really important is the statute at issue was implemented before there was a biofuels industry. And again, what the governor's bill does is it clarifies, it provides uniformity and predictability to the tax classification of certain components, and perhaps more importantly, it harmonizes Minnesota's goal to displace more petroleum with homegrown renewable biofuels. So all in all, biofuels, beer, wine, distilled beverages, and dairy products industries have lots of strengthening, if you will, that comes from the governor's bill to clarify what has been a problem in counties across the state. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for answering the question and for your testimony. Ms. Brenda Scandin is who I have next. Welcome to the committee. Come on up. And I will just read the next couple of people. I have Carrie Hansen after that, Brian Rice, Nan Madden, in that order. So please, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for letting me speak, and I thank you for the bill that you introduced, 1777. I appreciate it. It has a lot of good things in there, but I'm speaking specifically about the tax forgiveness compliance with the federal government for short sale foreclosures. Up until 2008, I was a business owner. I owned a corporation, and I was a controller for that corporation for 20 years. That business ended in 2008 when the economy fell. And at that time, I put my home up for sale, so it was on the market for 6 years. And I had purchased my home for $600,000 in Mound on Lake Minnetonka in 2004. And 2013, I finally sold it for $200,000. So it was a huge loss to my husband and myself. And in August 29th, I read the, I get the transcripts of the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I noted on there that it said that they were not compliant with the federal government for the tax forgiveness for loss on a short seller foreclosure. In 2009, I got my real estate license. I saw 8,000 agents gave up their license, and so I decided, since I could not get another job in my field, I decided to be a real estate agent, and I was one of the first people in the state of Minnesota to be certified by the National Association of Realtors to help people with short sales and foreclosures. So I helped countless people, and people that I always thought in the past were negligent with their finances or were irresponsible in their finances. And when it happened to me, I saw what really can happen to someone in a short amount of time, that you can lose everything. And so I would really appreciate it if this bill could get passed into law. I've reviewed Governor Dayton's bill, and I'm so appreciative that he's included that in there, because it isn't right that someone should lose their home and then be taxed on the money that's forgiven by the bank. I mean, it's money that we never see. If you go through a short sale, which I'm sure, I don't know if any of you have done that before, but your credit gets ruined. I mean, right now, my tax liability would be anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 I'll owe. I cannot get a loan to pay that back. As a realtor, if at any time I owe over $500 to the Minnesota Department of Revenue, my license can be revoked. So my only source of income will now be lost. I've talked to Mr. Michael, and he's told me that I can make up a payment plan, but that will be devastating to me to have a tax liability to that amount. So I really appreciate the fact that the House of Representatives has passed this bill, that Governor Dayton is in support of this bill and has created a bill that's included that. And I don't know if there's anything else that I can do to help encourage the Senate to also pass this bill and let it become law. And ideally, as a realtor, it should become permanent law, because anyone that's lost a home from a short sale foreclosure or has refinanced because of their underwater, I don't believe should ever be taxed. I've done a report using the MLS, and the tax liability to the state for 2013 is under $2 million. It's very, very small amount that the state will receive from taxing these people. So it's not a huge tax amount that you're collecting anyway from these people, but it's huge to the people individually that have lost their homes. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Scandin. Appreciate that. Next, we have Carrie Hansen. And Ms. Scandin, really appreciate it. It's difficult to talk about. I could hear it in your voice. And I think we all know people. The Great Recession has put lots of people in this situation that people couldn't see this coming. So we really appreciate it, and thank you for being here. Carrie Hansen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. I'm here for the same reason that Brenda is. I've had a very similar experience. I am a special education teacher, and before the recession, my husband owned his own fixture installation business that worked with commercial construction, which obviously went by the wayside during the recession. We went through bankruptcy in 2011, and the short sale of our house last February in 2013. We have since moved to a rental townhouse. Before the recession, we never missed a payment on our house, and we exhausted all avenues in trying to keep it, including taking money out of our 401k. And then it was a few months ago we were surprised to find out that the state of Minnesota did not comply with the federal government on the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act. This for us would mean a tax bill of thousands of dollars, and I don't think I need to explain to anybody that someone who's gone through bankruptcy and has lost their home does not have thousands of dollars with which to pay a tax bill on money that we felt we never received that has been counted as income. I do understand the importance of putting money, you know, putting the surplus money into the state coffers, and I agree that that needs to be done, and I believe Governor Dayton has already proposed that a portion of that money for just that. I would love to put money away for a rainy day, but if I need to pay this amount of taxes, I'm not going to be able to do that. If ever, I'm 60 years old, and we are just beginning to get back on our feet and start to recover from the financial situation that we have been in. If we need to file taxes without this law being passed, it means we'll have to negotiate with the state for a payment plan, which then would add interest to that, and we obviously don't have the means to pay it in full. You know, this was not income to us. I did not see any income from the short sale of my house. It was the loss of my home. And so I'm just here to once again say, you know, this bill really needs to be passed to help all Minnesotans who are trying to recover financially from the same type of situation that Brenda and I have been in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and we really appreciate the chance to hear from real citizens whose lives are impacted by this. Next, we have Brian Rice, and as Mr. Rice is coming up, I'd just like to remind members and the public that we can squeeze everyone in if everyone will keep their testimony to a minute or two, and then we won't have to reconvene this evening. And so if you have a comment to make that someone else has mentioned, you could just say, I'd like to endorse this topic without having to give us the whole paragraph. That'd be great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5. ASM Council 5 supports the governor's budget in general. We'd like to compliment the governor and this legislature for the work he did last year making this situation possible with a $1.2 billion surplus. This is the first time that the state in a number of years has had a stable, positive forecast that allows the legislature to make some choices both with regard to tax reductions and possible investments. And by and large, we're in agreement with the governor's budget. Representative Carlson's committee set the targets. We're in great agreement with the work that his committee has done, particularly with the supplemental funding for the Department of Health and Human Services for those people who work with our disabled and long-term care patients. We support the direction the House is going with significant funds for bonding, capital improvements, higher education, and transportation. And with respect to this tax bill, you've already passed a large part of this measure out, but we'd support efforts in moving money into local government aid or other appropriate property tax measures. So those are our comments.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. And next we have Nan Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project, followed by Michael Miller and Bruce Hagberg. And just to make things happen quickly, since we're under some time constraints, if people can come up and, you know, we've got room for a couple of people at the witness table, we'll have less transfer time. So if you could come up, Michael, that'd be great. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I want to express our thanks to Governor Dayton for his commitment to making the tax system work better for low and moderate income families. And for us, one of the most important pieces of his tax bill in that regard is the federal conformity to address marriage penalties in the working family credit. We see this as an essential first step in reducing regressivity in the tax system, and we thank the House for making it a priority as well. We also agree with the governor's emphasis on building more robust reserves in order to prepare for the next economic downturn. Adequate reserves will help the state better meet the needs of Minnesotans the next time we fall on hard times. Another element of the governor's tax proposal we support is creating a standalone estate tax and eliminating the bubble. I am concerned about the size of the governor's estate and gift tax proposal and prefer the approach that Representative Lencheski is taking in her estate tax bill, which addresses the technical problems of the estate tax without providing large tax cuts for high-value estates. We do appreciate Governor Dayton drawing attention to the cost of child care. I think it should be a discussion about what's the right balance in tax policy and direct appropriations. I wonder if instead of having no income ceiling on the cost, no income ceiling for the child and dependent care credit, as this bill proposes, if whether instead we could consider funding the basic sliding fee child care assistance, which has a waiting list well over 8,000 Minnesota families. I think that might be a more timely way to help low and moderate income families meet their monthly child care bills. But I think it's appropriate to think about a mix of tax policy and direct appropriations for child care. I do want to raise a concern about the size of this bill, which reaches over $1 billion in the next biennium. And we think it's very critical this year that policymakers not go too far in tax cutting. And it's especially dangerous to make large permanent tax cuts based on projected future surpluses. We have just come through more than a decade of frequent budget deficits, and the surpluses are not money in the bank. So we're not anxious to go back to those years of deficits, and so I want to express a caution about the size of the tax cuts here. I do appreciate the opportunity to testify and encourage you as you make final tax decisions this session to continue to focus on making the tax system work better for low and moderate income Minnesotans, to reduce regressivity, but also build up our reserves and be cautious about committing to large future permanent tax cuts. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Madden. And Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee. And next we'll have Bruce Hagberg, if you could join us at the witness table. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Miller. I'm here on behalf of Clarity and Hood, which is a law firm in St. Paul.
Excuse me, someone's phone again is too close. Thank you. You can begin
All
again.
All right, I'm sorry about that. That might have been mine. Again, I'm Mike Miller with Flaherty and Hood on behalf of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The Greater Minnesota Partnership is a group of economic development authorities, chambers of commerce, businesses, and cities across Minnesota, across Greater Minnesota, who are working for better economic opportunities outside of the seven-county metro area. And I'm here today to talk about the Angel Investment Program, Representative Simonson kind of brought it up earlier. The governor has recommended $15 million for the Angel Investment Program. This is a program that's created, according to a deed report, about 500 jobs in Minnesota since its inception. The problem that we're seeing within it's the same problem Representative Simonson's seeing is that 90% of that money is staying in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And it's not necessarily a matter, we think, of investors just wanting to invest in their own backyard. There are three separate problems that we're seeing with this law, the way it's currently written. First is that there's limits on the type of businesses that can receive this money. It's generally technological-based businesses. It's businesses with some proprietary sort of realm that they work in. What we're looking for is to expand the program to mining, agribusiness, manufacturing, timber-related, the businesses that are inherent to Greater Minnesota. Another problem that we're seeing with this legislation is that the wage demands are far too high for Greater Minnesota. The way the law is written, these startup businesses have to pay approximately $20 an hour to new employees. In Greater Minnesota, that's just not viable. We would recommend getting it to $15 an hour, closer to the high end of Greater Minnesota's average wage. Finally, while a lot of investors do live in the Twin Cities area, we could get them to invest in businesses in Greater Minnesota by increasing the percentage of the refund. If we bumped that up to 50%, people would be incentivized to look outside the Golden Crescent of Hennepin County and find those innovative businesses in Greater Minnesota. So in closing, I urge the committee to take a look at Representative Norton's bill, which addressed all of these concerns, and hopefully include that in your final package. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for coming here to testify, and welcome Mr. Hagberg, and next will be John Alexander.
Hi. Come on down. Hi, just to clarify, I'm Justin Zinanko from Recombinex. I've taken his place.
Oh, and could you tell us your name again, please?
Justin Zinanko from Recombinex.
Oh, welcome.
I'm here basically as representative CFO of the company to support the Angel Tax Credit Program and the expansion. We are a biotech company that was started out of the University of Minnesota in accelerating agriculture and also in biomedicine. And basically, we have pretty much hit our cap. We have used this credit to gain investment and to really build on the new technologies that biotech is here to offer for our own resources back home. One of the bills that we have seen come up was talking about having geographic restrictions. We think that would be a mistake, as a lot of the new technological advancements are coming out of universities and similar close proximities. And what we're looking at right now is, in our development stage, we're now looking at expanding into Glencoe, Minnesota, where we're looking at using infrastructure. But if we wouldn't have that tax credit and we wouldn't have gained the investment, we wouldn't have that opportunity. And so we really want to urge the committee to really take that up and look at expanding. And this is really, you know, about Minnesota jobs and a lot of Minnesota opportunities here. So we just want to further say that the tax credit was a great help for us to get investment into our company. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zinanko, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Alexander. And then next we will have up Sissa Keller from New Horizons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name again is John Alexander. To put my comments in context, I moved to Minnesota approximately 22 years ago as an officer of St. Jude Medical after living in 15 other states. Since leaving St. Jude, after diversifying the company into cardiac rhythm management and increasing the employee base from 500 employees to 2,600 employees, I've both consulted and had C-level positions in a variety of mostly medical technology startups. But I'm also the founder of Twin Cities Angels, so I'm here to speak on the Angel Investment Tax Credit, really from both perspectives, both as an investor and a beneficiary of the funding that that provides. From 1996 to 2000, I invested as an individual angel, found it very difficult to do so, found it hard to find collaborators and co-investors, And this was very, very different from what I found on both the East and the West Coast. And this was really the genesis of the Minnesota Angel Investment Tax Credit. I was involved with the bill from the first draft in 2000 and fought for it each year for the next 10 years that it took to pass. The purpose of this really was to reduce the risk of investing in very high-risk early-stage technology companies and expand the technology here in Minnesota, keep the people and the technology and those high-tech jobs here in Minnesota. And the result was that, as you've heard in the report last week and again early this afternoon, was that more capital became available. Individuals took money out of their own pockets, out of their own savings, to make individual bets in technology, companies, and people. And as a result, it made it easier to bring other people into transactions, diversify your own risk in making an investment, and then move the company ahead quickly and efficiently. You know, now that the Angel Investment Tax Credit is out, it's dramatic, the change, both at the end of the previous few years where the tax credit ran out during the year, and then most recently when it ran out per the original legislation. The risk is higher. Many of the investors, like before 2010, and just generally in this tough economy, are less willing to make any investment, and if it is, it's smaller. It takes a lot more time and effort, both on the part of that investor, the investor group that may participate, and then the company. You know, I'd like to see the program expanded and extended. Continue to focus on early stage technology companies that take time to mature. 5 years is too short a time for a bill like this. An additional 10 or even 15 would be better to show the value as those companies go from the light bulb going off in an engineer, a physician's, an inventor's mind to the point where they have enough people to begin throwing off people and creating new companies based on the environment that they have. In terms of funding, we've worked over the last several years to try and increase the funding to match that of our nearest neighbor. Wisconsin's credit was increased to $20 million a number of years ago. That plus the demand, as we've seen the credit run out in November and July and most recently the 3rd of March, that would bring us back to a parity that would allow us to both meet demand and compete with our nearest neighbors. It would also be nice if it would grow each year for the next several years so that it would continue to meet that. We've made a couple of tweaks to the bill to both decrease the gaming, as very smart people looked at the language and figured out a way to make the most of it that did not necessarily apply to the intent. But there are some ideas floating around that don't necessarily match the intent. One of those is carving out a portion for greater Minnesota, allocating monies to a specific region, gender, or minority subgroup doesn't really comply with the original intent. You know, as we all saw from the original Job Z bill, regional programs don't work. Other states also tried this in their initial foray into these types of investment tax credits and pulled them back. Emerging technology companies need infrastructure, they need people, they need the spin-off people and technology from companies that tend to be around metropolitan areas than they can find in an outstate area. However, as they grow and are looking for different resources, lower costs, they will then will naturally expand where it is less expensive. But to try to legislate that is pushing against the natural inclinations. And then just in terms of fairness, there are other tax credits and grants and stimulants that support greater Minnesota disproportionate to what happens inside the Beltway, such as agricultural and mining activities.
If there Thank are any you questions, very I'd be happy much. To answer them. Appreciate your testimony. I have to tell you, people, we are doing great. We have six more people, and people are being really respectful of the time, and maybe we'll get an evening back yet. Welcome to the committee, and after this, we have Mr. Dane Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cisa Keller, and I am the Government Relations Committee Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. MCCA is an association of almost 250 licensed child care centers in Minnesota that operate as small businesses. MCCA is here to support the governor's proposal to expand the number of households that would be eligible to receive the child care tax credit. You work with or know someone who depends on child care every day. If your coworker, your employee, your friend, your relative, or your business associate does not have reliable child care, they will likely miss work, turn to you for help, or leave the workforce entirely. According to the Minnesota Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development, 72% of families in Minnesota have both parents in the workforce. In addition, Minnesota is the sixth highest female labor workforce participation in the country. It's 67.4%. Under the governor's proposal, 170,000 families would be eligible for the child care tax credit. Depending on income, families would receive a credit between 20 and 35% of their child care expenses. As a child care provider, we know that child care expenses can represent a significant portion of a young family's monthly expenses at a time when that family is just beginning their earning potential. We also know that these expenses are necessary not only for the parents' ability to go to work every day, but also for the young development towards school readiness and lifelong success. The child care tax credit would provide many Minnesota families with the financial assistance with these costs, particularly middle and low income families. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Smith. And then we'll have Jeff Van Wyken followed by Bo Berenstain. And appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice. We do policy research and advocacy around the idea of building a broader prosperity in Minnesota. We think there is a lot to like in the governor's bill. We've always favored tax policies that, when possible, could reduce business taxes. They are at least mildly regressive, and we see a lot of that on the state and sales and use tax. We want to congratulate the governor in this bill for continued focus on progressivity from the federal conformity portion, the working family credit. All of that is important, and conformity, of course, is an important way to make the system less frustrating and confusing for taxpayers. So that federal update and the individual income tax portions are good. Last year's tax bill was really crucially important. It was an important historic point in our state that narrowed the gap between what most Minnesotans pay in taxes and a smaller share that the wealthiest pay in state and local taxes. That advance in progressivity was really important in this time of rising inequality. It also resolved for the near future our deficit. It restored funding in vital public infrastructure and investment in human capital, something that business actually values and needs. And we really can't go backward on that. So we do have some concern that the estate cut, tax cuts, and the gift tax provide more relief than is necessary to the largest estates, and it partially undoes the work that was done last year towards a less regressive tax system. We also share the Council of Nonprofits' concern in the Minnesota Budget Project with the total size, $1.1 billion coming off a long period of budget shortfalls. Seems a little rich, and it's not just because it makes us more vulnerable in the last downturn. I've been an observer of budgets and economic forecasts in this state for 30 years, and it seems like every time we have a surplus, people end up regretting too large permanent income tax and other revenue reductions. So we just want to issue a note of warning on the size of that. It's not just a problem that makes us more vulnerable in the next downturn, but it's a lost opportunity cost. We really need to invest more in early childhood education and preparing our workforce. Business agrees on this, and so overall, a good bill. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Van Wyken, and please begin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Van Wyken. I'm Director of Tax Studies for Minnesota 20.
And please begin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Van Wyken. I'm Director of Tax Studies for Minnesota 2020. Thank you for the opportunity to speak regarding the governor's tax bill. First of all, we support the federal conformity measures in the bill, especially in regard to the working family credit. You've already heard good testimony on that. I will not repeat it. Regarding the three business-to-business sales taxes, last spring we noted the tax pyramiding problems associated with these taxes. Now would be a good time to repeal them, as the governor is proposing, given that the revenue is no longer needed in light of the surplus. We are less enthusiastic about the governor's plan to raise the estate tax exemption from $1 million to $2 million. The estate tax is the most progressive tax we have, and reductions to it will increase tax regressivity, and the price tag is steep, ramping up to over $110 million in the next biennium and more after that. We realize that there are problems with the current estate tax in the form of uneven jumps in the marginal rate, but these are addressed in a more systematic and affordable way in Chair Lincheski's bill, House File 2108. Finally, as much as is prudently possible, we would urge the governor and the legislature to refrain from tax cuts and spending increases so as to allow for a significant increase in the state budget reserve. The 2009 State Budget Trend Study Commission recommended on a bipartisan basis to increase the budget reserve to $2 billion. The reserve is currently at half this amount. Increasing the reserve will provide a cushion against unanticipated revenue volatility, bolster the state's credit rating, and is perhaps the most responsible use of a budget reserve, which may or may not materialize in 15 months when the current biennium comes to a close. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for your time.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Berenson. And next we will have Brian Rushi after you.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. In the interest of time, I'm going to share with you the support from the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the League of Minnesota Cities for Article 2, Section 5 of the bill, which would provide significant savings to local taxpayers by extending the current local government sales tax exemption to cover joint powers, special districts, and other collaborative entities. This important clarification is one of AMC's top legislative priorities this session. As a recent report from the legislative auditor noted, counties utilize joint powers and collaborative enterprises more frequently than any other unit of local government. In fact, state statute frequently will mandate or provide significant incentives to smaller counties to deliver services jointly. However, these joint powers and collaborative entities are now effectively being penalized in the tax code, which we know is never the intention of the governor nor the legislature. We very much appreciate the time the Department of Revenue has spent with us this summer working on this language, and thank the governor for including it as a supplemental budget. We urge the committee to approve this in your omnibus tax bill. I'd also lend our support to some of the sales tax provisions you heard last week as we were discussing this issue, specifically a provision in House File 2195 that would provide greater clarity to local governments on the list of items that remain taxable when purchased by local governments. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rushi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rushi, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Want to commend the governor's proposal on a couple of scores and then talk about one of our concerns. Mm-hmm. We very much like the federal conformity provisions, especially that that occurs with the standard deduction and with the working family credit to close the marriage penalty. We definitely support that and the ensuing increase in the working family credit for many of those filers. We also like the governor's approach in terms of the overall reserve at the end of the current and next biennium. I've lived through enough budget cycles, like some of my colleagues, and have noticed over the years that the downturns always seem to hurt more than they should, and that we end up cutting programs that people really rely on because when times were better, we didn't do a good job of putting grain in the storehouse, if you will. And that's just an important thing that I hope that you'll recognize, and I want to praise the governor for being a little more prudent in that regard. I also like what many others have said about the child and dependent care credit. I think that's an important acknowledgement of the cost that families face. Comes right out of the recommendations of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty and the Families Economic Security Act. But again, I also think that there's some things that we should do on the appropriation side, maybe even before that, with the child care assistance program and the waiting list that Ms. Madden referenced earlier. My biggest concern is that we, as others have noted, are eroding our tax base to a huge extent, $1.1 billion in the 16-17 biennium. And that we're doing it largely on progressive tax sources. The gift and estate tax are very progressive in terms of how they impact the overall system. So I'm worried about the shape of the curve, if you will. Where are we going with our fiscal and tax policy in terms of overall ability to pay as a basis for our tax system?
I think that we're being a little more measured and a little more careful, and I think I would have more support for what's going on in Jared Lencheski's bill than the governor's approach to the gift and estate tax. Overall, as you put the bill together, I just urge you to focus, as you have, and as the governor's suggesting, on low and moderate income households. Reduce the regressivity that's inherent in our tax system because of sales and property taxes, and that we really seriously look at this as a sustainable fiscal system and realize we're enjoying pretty good years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. And that is the last name I have on the list, but is there anyone else who would like to testify on the tax bill? Please come up and introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Conry. I'm here today for Take Action Minnesota. I wanted to start by saying I'll keep it short and to thank this committee and the governor for the progress we made last year on both increasing the adequacy and progressivity of our tax code overall. And wanted to also start by applauding a number of things in this this tax plan that I think work well. We're glad there's real progress on the working family credit, on the child and dependent care credit, the marriage penalty fix, and increasing our reserves as a state. But one concern we'd have overall would be the overall proportion between tax cuts, investments, and reserves. And in particular, would like to see the would encourage you to consider making the tax cut portion of it smaller. And the one place we'd direct your attention would be to the estate tax. In the recent report from Department of Revenue, on the estate tax, there was an option 3C that they outlined, which was essentially a revenue-neutral approach to fixing the bubble and dealing with other kind of technical issues with the estate tax. We'd encourage you to look at that approach. Chair Lencheski's approach gets some, you know, some good distance towards that. And so as you're putting the bill together, please keep that in mind. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Ms. Kadoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Kadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll be very brief. We do want to thank the governor and the commissioner for their continued support for repealing all three of the business-to-business tax and for his advocacy and urging for an early tax bill. We certainly think that's important. We appreciate the recognition that the detrimental impact of those three taxes are having on Minnesota's economy and Minnesota's business climate. We do support the House's applying that retroactive in the in doing the refunds. We're supportive of the federal conformity. We appreciate the gift tax being repealed, where that really does make Minnesota an outlier, and do believe that the estate tax threshold does need to get increased, because once again, Minnesota is one of only 14 states that do have an estate tax. And with that, I'll thank you.
Thank you so much. And not seeing anyone else who's anxious to testify, I just want to say a personal thanks and a thanks, I think, on behalf of the committee to everyone who kept their comments concise. And if you forgot something in trying to be very short, we can always email or write us and share that information. We have one last item, and that is approval of the minutes of March 13th. Thank you very much, Representative Alcock. All in favor say aye. Opposed, nay? And with that, we will lay the bill over before us for possible inclusion in the tax bill. Thank you so much. We are adjourned.